There's a better world to come in. Tell you why. There's a better world to come in. Tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come in. Tell you why. Better world to come in, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free, there's a better world to come in, don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, it's Progressive News Network. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, news director, and tonight's show we call The Post-Primary Predicament. We've got some wonderful guests for you tonight. Luis Cuevas, executive director of Progressive Push, a regular friend of the show, an exemplary progressive leader. We got a guest from the West Coast, Larry Aguilar. He was the candidate for District 79 as state representative, but as you'll hear, he had some difficulties with the state. We've got Susan Smith giving us her perspective on the primary behind us and the battle ahead. We've got Will Rankin, who is candidate for the Florida CFO position, and I think you'll be very impressed with what he's got to tell you. And Athena Ford, who is the outreach coordinator for Florida Chain, an organization that's one of the prime navigators for the Affordable Care Act, and she has information that will definitely help you as you prepare for the next sign-up session. And as you all know, there is plenty of changes ahead for the Affordable Care Act, and with any luck at all, we will continue to see the care expanded and additional people and additional coverage for all of us. And now the news. Heavy equipment falls into the Fukushima reactor. A 400-kilogram, that's an 880-pound machine, fell into the nuclear fuel pool at Japan's crippled Fukushima plant Friday. And, of course, they said, there's no problem with that. No significant changes. And, of course, we know that by TEPCO's own reports, they can't be trusted no matter what they say. The Tokyo Electric Power, or TEPCO, said it has not detected, it has not detected any significant changes in radiation readings or the level of the pool water at the number 3 reactor. Of course, you drop 880 pounds of anything into a radioactive pool, and that certainly means fun. A massive earthquake and tsunami back in 2011, well beyond the range of most people's memory, ravaged Japan's northeastern coast and wrecked the plant, which was built on landfill over a subterranean river, which, of course, explains all that water. The Friday accident occurred just before noon during a remotely controlled operation to remove debris from the fuel pool at the unit where the broken reactor still lies untouched. The pool contains an estimated 566 fuel rods and 800 pounds, half a ton, of damaged equipment that has now fallen in. But, of course, everything's all right. Everything's all right. Everything's all right. The operating console of the fuel handling machine slipped loose and fell into the pool as it was about to be lifted by a crane. That's the operating console of the fuel handling machine, which slipped loose and fell into the pool as it was about to be lifted by a crane so that they could then deal with, you know, plucking the fuel rods. But everything's okay, so don't worry about it. And TEPCO has also assured us, and we know we can trust them, the radiation readings at the pool remained unchanged at 3.2 millisieverts per hour after the incident, the statement said. Soon to be revised. Oh, that's right. I added the soon to be revised. Operation was being remotely controlled, and there were no injuries caused to any of the workers. Also, probably a misstatement of fact. Meltdowns at Fukushima were the world's worst nuclear mishap since the 1986 Chernobyl disaster, which forced hundreds of thousands of local residents to evacuate nearby areas. In a vivid reminder of the fragility of the area, a magnitude 5.0 quake struck off the Fukushima coast hours after Friday's incident. That's the Earth, no doubt, saying, hey, thank you. And please continue. Surveillance on Facebook. Who would have thunk it? Oh, that's right. A whistleblower told us. The U.S. government can brand you a terrorist based on your Facebook postings. Innocent people's lives are being ruined. Why isn't anyone watching the watch list? This is from the British The Guardian. The U.S. government's web of surveillance is vast and interconnected. Now we know just how opaque, how inefficient, and how discriminatory it can be. As if we needed reminded again this week, you can be pulled into the National Security Agency's database quietly and quickly, and the consequences can be long and enduring. Through IcReach, a Google-style search engine created for the intelligence community, the NSA provides data on private communications to 23 government agencies. More than 1,000 analysts had access to that information. This kind of data sharing, however, isn't limited to the latest from Edward Snowden's NSA files. It was confirmed earlier this month that the FBI shares its master watch list on the terrorist screening database with at least 22 foreign governments, countless federal agencies, state and local law enforcement, and, of course, the private contractors. The watch list tracks known and suspected terrorists and includes both foreigners and Americans. It's also based on loose standards and secret evidence which ensnares innocent people. Indeed, the standards are so low that the U.S. government's guidelines specifically allow for a single, uncorroborated source of information, including a Facebook or Twitter post, to serve as the basis for putting you on its master watch list. No problems there, huh? Of the 680,000 individuals on the FBI master list, roughly 40% have no recognized terrorist group affiliations, and that's according to Intercept, the new Greenwald piece. These individuals don't even have a connection, as the government loosely defines it, to any designated terrorist group, but they're still branded as suspected terrorists, because, hey, you remember, innocent until proven guilty. Absurdities don't end there. Take Dearborn, Michigan, a city with a population of under 100,000, that it's known for its large Arab-American community and has more watch list residents than any other city in America except New York. These eye-popping numbers are largely a result of the government's use of a loose standard called a reasonable suspicion in determining who exactly can be watch listed. Reasonable suspicion is such a low standard because it requires neither concrete evidence nor irrefutable evidence. Instead, an official is permitted to consider reasonable inferences and to draw from the facts in the light of his or her own experience. Consider a real-world context, actual criminal justice, where an officer needs reasonable suspicion to stop a person on the street and ask him or her a few questions. Courts have controversially held that avoiding eye contact with an officer, traveling alone, and traveling late at night, for example, are all amount to reasonable suspicion. Innocent until proven guilty. Innocent until proven guilty. This vague criteria is now being used to label innocent people as terrorist suspects. Moreover, because the watch list isn't limited to known and actual terrorists, an official can watch list a person if he has a reasonable suspicion to believe that the person is a suspected terrorist. It's a circular logic. Individuals can be watch listed if they are suspected of being a suspected terrorist. That's ultimately backwards and must be changed. The government's self-mandated surveillance guidelines also include loopholes that permit watch listing without even showing reasonable suspicion. For example, non-citizens can be watch-listed for being associated with a watch-listed person, even though their relationship with that person is entirely innocuous. Another catch-all exception allows non-citizens to be watch-listed as long as the source or tipster describes the person as an extremist or a militant, or in similar terms, and the context suggests a nexus to terrorism. The FBI's definition of nexus, in turn, is even more nebulous than they're letting on. Because the watch list designation process is secret, there's no way of knowing just how many innocent people have been added to the list due to these absurdities and loopholes. And yet, history shows that innocent people are inevitably added to the list and suffer life-altering consequences. Life on the master list can trigger enhanced screening at borders and airports. Being on the no-fly list, which is a subset of the larger terrorist watch list, can prevent airline travel altogether. The watch list can separate family members for more months or years, isolate individuals from friends and associates, and ruin employment prospects. Just as a point of reference, one of the Supreme Court justices of the Florida Supreme Court was watchlisted to the extent of being forbidden to travel by plane. That's right. Supreme Court Justice of Florida was actually forbidden to travel by plane. Yep. A real watch list kind of guy. After a year-long investigation by the Center for Public Integrity revealed that health insurers may have fleeced taxpayers out of $70 billion in just the past 5 years. This is from a headline called Insurers Are Fleecing Us Out of Billions While Congress Looks the Other Way. You would think that members of Congress in both parties would be so outraged they'd be launching their own investigations and railing against the fraud and abuse they decry on the campaign trail. Not holding out much hope. That's because just how powerful and influential the health insurance industry is and how its lobbyists almost always get what they want out of Congress and the White House, regardless of who's sitting in the Oval Office. The Center's Medical Advantage Money Grab investigation, led by veteran reporter Fred Schulte, found that if federal officials made $70 billion in improper payments to Medicare Advantage plans from 2008 to 2013, mostly by overbillings, by manipulating or misusing Medicaid payment in a tool called the Risk Score. From 2007 to 2011, Medicare Advantage risk scores rose more than twice as fast as the average for people in standard Medicare in more than 500 counties nationwide. Remember, as always, if you go to averyvoice.com, you can get additional glimpses of the news and follow the links. So I, again, encourage you to go to averyvoice.com and check out the rest of the news items that I haven't had a chance to read. And now, ladies and gentlemen, let me bring on my first guest, the incomparable, the talented, the insightful, the political leader we all believe has got a firm sense of what's going on. Let me bring on Mr. Luis Cuevas.
Hey there.
Hey, brother. How you doing tonight?
I am doing great. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty good, sir. Doing pretty good. Trying
Fantastic.
To get the word out to the people. And, sir, I wanted to ask you, what's your take on Florida's recent primary?
In simple terms, disturbing but not unpredictable.
Right.
It was a matter of, I think, the most interesting thing, perhaps the most disturbing, was the low voter turnout across the entire state. Now, for primaries and situations like the ones we had, that is relatively common, but it's becoming a real problem because it means that the parties, in terms of the Democratic Party, is not moving the voters. And even though, it's hard to take a look at county by county and then all of the school board races and the city commissions, county commissions, and all that as an aggregate. But when we're looking at the whole picture, we're looking at the fact that Republicans had actually a higher turnout than Democrats. Some people are going to say, well, that, you know, that bodes badly on the Democrats. On the other hand, you say that, yes, that is true, that Republicans, in the governor's primary showed up more, is because that they actually had more big races within the Republican Party than did the Democratic Party for the state Senate and the House. So that drew in more people. The reason that is disturbing is because we think in terms of you know, 146,000 more ballots were actually cast in seven Republican Senate races than in two Democratic races. So that's, you know, that when you look at crunch the numbers, that becomes a problem. You know, overall, the picture is, you know, if there are more Republican elections, there's more chance more Republicans will vote. And that is really, you know, becomes a problem in terms of how many candidates we have out there running. You know, voting is a matter of interest. And people vote if an election and the candidates are interesting. So if you got, you know, people who are fired up about a number of candidates, they will show up. And that is where, you know, we're concerned that progressives, liberals, Democrats, Greens, everybody who's on this side of the road needs to show up if we're going to, you know, make a change. Now, that said, when we turn over to the Crist Rich race, and we look at it, you know, we I mean, it was 74% of the vote, or a 3-to-1 margin that went to Crist. You know, and the only one problem for Crist will be eventually that he could not get, you know, votes in Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach. They did not turn out to vote. There wasn't that much enthusiasm. But to take the other side of the story, you're going to say, well, was this predictable? Yes. There was a predictability ratio here. You know, people pretty much have had a view of the race, and they said, well, this is what's going to happen, you know, and Charlie Crist has more firepower behind him than does Nance Rich. And the problem was that, you know, we have a good candidate. I mean, Nance Rich is a good candidate, but she suffered from lack of money, name recognition outside of her, you know, district. She did not have a firebrand, you know, burning style that could attract a huge amount of grassroots support in the whole process. So essentially is that there you go to then the campaign themselves. And who has the best campaign management? Who has the best campaign, you know, overall? And obviously, Crist won the, you know, big on the primary night. You know, that is a picture that we get. So that means that might have affected overall turnout. But when we're going to go now to the big election, we go from the primary to the midterm, then there is much more interest because the race between Crist and Scott is getting heated. In fact, is now at a point in which, you know, it all goes to who turns out. How many people turn out? And the biggest story here is going to be the demographics. In terms of who has the biggest appeal to the women, LGBT, who's got the black vote, the Latino vote, who can bring them in to vote. We think that, you know, overall, Crist would have that support. But that's up to his campaign to actually pull that in. You know, you just cannot predict. So it's a matter of the campaign going out there, registering large numbers of people. Like I said, you know, the demographics favor Charlie Crist, but only if he goes out there and he asks. Now, he's got a big asset. Annette Tadeo was a great choice for him.
Yeah.
And if he can, you know, she's awesome. And I mean, she's run against the, let's not call her meanest, but toughest of Republicans in South Florida, Ileana Ross-Lehtinen. She's a tough one, and she's got a great political machine in South Florida. And Annette, you know, did a great fight, even though she was left pretty much by herself. I mean, that was a race for Congress twice that she did out of her own blood, sweat, and tears. She did not really have a party backup on that one. For reasons that we can discuss later on. I think that you know where I'm going.
Sure.
If you want to go there, we will. But, you know, Annette doesn't say anything about it. But the fact is that, you know, in the king-making machine of the Democratic Party, there's a problem. And you know, progressives are not welcome that much in there.
Well, we were told to sit down and shut up, basically.
Yeah. It's a matter of, you know, we want your,
money.
What you call it, your energy, your money. We want your volunteers, but shut up. We don't need your ideas. You know, it just comes down to that. So you're gophers, for all we care. But when it comes to the other end of the story, no. That you're not welcome there. And so, you know, that's a problem for very many progressives, trying to run with the Democratic Party. And that is going to cause, problems because when you're saying that, you know, we go back to the whole idea that if elections are and candidates are interesting, people will turn out to vote. But if we are going to have this milquetoast candidates come in and they say that they're very much, I mean, oh, yeah, I agree with the Republican on this. The question for the voter is, well, why should I turn out and vote? You know, and then you go over to the voting record of these people, and you find it there, exactly how they go out and vote Republican every time. So what's the sense, many Floridians say? And by the way, in the state of Florida, there are more registered Democrats than Republicans. And I'm tired of hearing people say, well, yeah, them, you know, those Democrats are really Dixiecrats who don't turn on. Yeah. But, you know, when you come back to it and say, hey, wait a minute. Now, let's analyze what Nan Rich did. She actually got thousands of votes in quite conservative counties in the state of Florida. I mean, when you get votes in Gilchrist County, Florida, and counties that have, in northern Florida, for example, turned out and they voted more for her than did for Charlie Crist, then you're going to say, what's happening there? You see. And what the Democratic Party needs to know and needs to realize is that they have to look in terms of there is a populist element there that can attract people. You see, you just have to go after it. But you have to do it convincingly. You have to be assertive, and you have to let people know that you are sincere. And that's a problem that I see there. I mean, that's for the big election. And, you know, when we look at the numbers, when we look, you know, who was the last governor, Democratic governor elected in the state of Florida? That was Lawton Childs, 1994. Let's see. He passed away towards the end of his term, and McKay became, for a short period of time, the governor. And from there on, it was Bush, Charlie Crist, and then, you know, Voldemort. I mean, Scott, Rick Scott. But if you look at it, it means it's been a long, it's a drought. It's been a long drought. On the other hand, here's a lesson for the Democratic Party. And when we talked to Mark Pafford the other day, we agreed that, hey, listen, the Republicans keep running against themselves. They keep talking about, well, the taxes are too high, this is too bad, this is too bad. And then you ask, who's been in power all this time? You see, Jeb Bush came into power in 98 in that election, who's been in power in Florida? It's been the Republicans. Before that, in the House, it's been since 1992.
Louise, let me ask
then,
you.
Yes.
You know, we've got the Republicans out there actively hating women, actively working against the Hispanic immigrant community.
Right.
We've got them clearly working with gun nuts, working in every anti-tolerance vein, possibly vein, you can work. And yet,
right on.
The ridiculous Democratic Party has managed to lose against that kind of thinking. It is beyond belief.
Yes, it's the most pathetic thing I've seen in politics ever. I mean, they cannot turn that back on these people and say, well, hey, you manage. I mean, you are really about equality. You offend everybody equally. You see, you have managed to insult every gender group, every religious group, every racial group. I mean, they have offended the black community, the Hispanic Latino community, Asian community. They've tried to play games
let's
of one group
women.
Against the other. Huh?
And let's not leave out women.
They think that that's a Democratic problem. You know, the women are really a problem because the Democrats can't get their votes, so they blame the Republicans. You know, it's a twisted mind that they have. I don't know what they've been smoking up there, but, you know, when you think about it, there's no basis for anything they do. They have been offensive to every single group, voting group out there. But the question is, why can't the Democrats pull out the vote? And I'm here going to throw a name.
Sure.
And the name is Steny Hoyer. And he is, and I throw in another name just for the sake of it, Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
Uh-huh.
Because they are in charge of candidates. New candidates, finding out candidates and running them for office. But they have a knack for Republican-like,
yeah.
Republican-light, blue
yep.
dogs. They call themselves New Democrats. You name everything in the book, but calling themselves Democrats. And they recruit them. They pay them, they give them money, they support them, they won't back any progressive who tries to run. They will ruin that progressive, but they will get new recruits. I call them Blue Dog Poppy Mill, that they go out and they turn them around.
Luis,
yes,
my next guest is going to have some thoughts on that, too. This is going to be Mr.
Excellent.
Larry Aguilar, who was running for District 79. Let me bring him on.
Yes, Lee County. Fantastic.
Mr. Aguilar, welcome, sir.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be on your show.
Sir, we're so happy to have you. I want you to first talk a little bit about yourself, what got you interested in running, and then I'd like you to talk about your candidacy and some of the things that fell out in that situation, sir. Welcome.
Well,
you know,
thank
most
you.
People
thank
find
you.
It more than enough work to just make a living, raise a family, have some friends, but it takes a special kind of person to say, look, I want to help. What was it in your life, sir, that brought you to that place where you wanted to help?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I grew up, I was born in Cuba. My parents obviously came to this country in the early 60s looking for a way out of that communism state. And we landed in, like most Cubans, in Miami, but only for just a short while. And then we settled in the true land of opportunity, that is New York City. There I got my education through public schools. And through the work of the many thousands of public educators who take an interest in children and champion them through the process of realizing that, hey, there is opportunity in this country. I landed in college in Boston, so I spent a good part of my life in Boston, obviously a very progressive state. And once my family was well enough to travel with me, we decided to move down to Florida, where the rest of my family had migrated back to. And, it's a totally different place to live, totally different mindset in Florida, especially if you think back to 1987, right after Ronald Reagan and into the Bush years. Florida isn't a haven for progressives now. Well, it wasn't for progressives then. Now, having grown up in New York City, I've always felt that people of color have always been taken for granted by, in my case, I can come out and say that I felt that the Democrats back in the day were taking people that looked like me and that spoke like me for granted, and so I was an independent for a very long time. And the reason why I became an independent was because I wanted someone to talk to the issues that were important to me as a black male who also happened to be Hispanic. And this is how I got interested in being a part of that message that needs to be conveyed to people like me who happened to be exploding at the time, coming from all parts of the world, Santo Domingo, Puerto Rico, and other parts of South America. And my focus was mainly in education. I got involved with LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, and through that organization, I became a little bit more aware that the problems that we face in our great country are usually the root cause is money. And when you start looking at the purse strings, you find that the people that here in Florida that have their hands all, in that money are Republicans. And I decided to draw a line in the sand, not straddle the fence and continue to be an independent. I felt that I needed to represent my district as a Democrat because I always had those values as a person. And I decided also that in order to fight what I thought was wrong and injustice, I felt that instead of just talking about it at the barbershop and other places, I needed to take the next step and throw my hat in the race.
Well, good for you, sir. Good for you. And tell us, when you decided to run, what did you feel was your agenda to take to the Florida legislature?
Well, the main thing is obviously here where I live, this is a red area. I mean, I have so many folks that would tell me, for instance, at FGCU, the university, the local university, I sit on the diversity board there. And when I first came out and told them that I was a candidate, about three professors came to me and said, hey, listen, there are a lot of us here that will support you. We just won't be able to do it openly. So when I tell you that a part of the agenda that I had when I decided to run was not only to go to Tallahassee and advocate for those people that cannot advocate for themselves and mainly through education, I also wanted to set the record straight. And there's a lot of business that gets done up there that the folks that elect representatives to go out and do their bidding for them to empower the communities, to empower the districts. What goes on in those meetings, those people, the voters never really know or hear about. And I felt that with today's technology, there would be absolutely no reason why, if chosen, I would not be able to do exactly what the voters of the district wanted me to do.
Right.
You know, and I really wanted to transform the way that things get done up there and make it, if I could make it just a little bit more transparent, I think that I would have gone a long way in getting my objectives done.
Mm-hmm. And now I understand that there were some technicalities that were used to, let me not be too prejudiced. Why don't you tell me tell us what happened? How the state, ruled your candidacy that it didn't meet the delivery criteria? Was that it?
and you can be prejudiced if you like, because I'm telling you that the one thing that's apparent here is that Republicans, Democrats, and Independents all agree that the evidence shows that my parcel of mail was there for their pickup. Now, the way that they have it set up here in Florida, the Department of Elections does not accept mail. In their instructions to the candidates, it explicitly states that they make several trips to the postal office to pick up the mail. Well, this is what they would have you believe. I sent my parcel of mail on Tuesday, June 17th. It was picked up at somewhere around 3:55. It was in Tallahassee in the morning hours of Wednesday, June 18. They did the processing as they do up there, and by the morning of Thursday, June the 19th, precisely at 8:44 a.m., my package became available for the Department of Elections to pick up that parcel. Now, I have a physical evidence that places the mail in their inbox, in their mailbox. They have nothing. They've never presented nothing to suggest that, yes, we went there and we picked up your mail. But yet, on the day a week ago, Thursday, this past Thursday, they presented some affidavits at the last minute. Essentially exclaimed that the person that initially said that they did not go out to pick up mail on qualifying day, that person was not actually the real person that went out to get mail. Someone did go out there. We don't know who the name is, but that person went to pick up mail at 7:30 in the morning on the day of qualifying, and they never went back. On the day of qualifying, they never went back. So that is the kind of testimony that was presented on Thursday from the Division of Elections by the attorneys representing them. And I fought a good fight. I think I made my argument very, very clear that not only was my document there on Thursday, there's a letter from Christy Bronson, who is the person responsible for accepting the qualifications and certifying them. And in that letter, she stated that she had my check, but she was disqualifying me anyways. You know, so that, there's just a lot of inconsistencies with their statements that could not be corroborated with true evidence on their part. And the only person that showed up in court with factual evidence was myself, and the judge decided to go with their affidavits and pretty much disregard the evidence from the postal office.
Well, of course, the Democratic Party stood up for you and put resources to bear to make sure that you were in that election. Is that the case?
No, unfortunately, and you know, there's been a little bit of talk about that from different groups that that represent the Democratic Party here, and I just want to set the record straight.
That's why I wanted you here.
Part, and thank you for giving me that opportunity. For the most part, you can imagine on June 20th, on Friday, I was. I don't know. Maybe I'm too carefree. I was not worried. I knew my parcel of mail made it. I had absolutely no reason to think that there would be a problem with my parcel of mail. When I received the call telling me that there was a problem, obviously, you know, my state of well-being changed very quickly. One of the calls, the first calls that I made, was to the local DEC office here, the place where all of my dreams really began. And unfortunately, things did not go as I had hoped. I think that there were more doubts cast on my actions. I think that for the most part, I spent valuable time trying to, it's almost like, you know, being accused of murder, and you're not even in the zip code where the murder occurred. You know, you just go berserk because I was being told that, come on, face it, you screwed up, and this is why we're having this problem, and until you admit that you screwed up, we can't move forward. And at that point, I was just looking up at the ceiling thinking, is this happening to me for real, that the people that are supposed to be in this thing together with me are the ones that are going to really put my back against the wall? So that was the introduction to the kind of support that that I was going to get. Thankfully, there is an attorney here who has served as my counsel and who also had a stint as a candidate. He ran for state representative. His name is Pete Burkert. I can say that because I'm proud to announce that he, from the beginning, he said, I will never leave a fellow Democrat stranded, and those were his words to me, which at that point was like medicine. And he got involved and called the FDP, and after a little bit of, back and forth, I think he got them to give me an opportunity to state my case. I did. I sent them the evidence that was available to anyone that was really interested in helping me. And the extent of the assistance that I received from the FDP was that Mark Herron, who's an attorney and part of the legal counsel up there in Tallahassee, and Scott Arsenault, they intervened and sent a letter to the Divisions of Elections and to Secretary of State Ken Zensler, essentially vouching for the evidence. And Pete Burkert had done some case law research and found that, lo and behold, this sort of thing happens quite a lot. There's ample case law on it. And it stipulates that at the point of presentment, when my parcel of mail was placed in the mailbox, guess what? That was considered delivered. The FDP sent a letter. The letter was resoundly rejected on that day, the 23rd of June, and I had a conference call with Scott Arsenault and Nick Polito at that time, and their words to me were that, hey, listen, we've done all that we can. We sent the letter. They're saying that the only way you're going to get on the ballot is if you take it to court. So you're on your own. You got to get a lawyer, and you got to, you know, you got to do whatever you got to do to get on the ballot. And that's what happened. Everything else is just a figment of someone's imagination. That's the extent of the help that I received.
So, what happened? Did you take it to court?
Oh, absolutely. Obviously, you know, and of course, there was the thought that, hey, how much could this thing wind up costing me? Of course, there were many people here that supported me, and when they saw the evidence, including some Republicans, they wanted to see the right thing happen. And I can tell you, even now when I go places and someone will recognize me from all of the appearances on television and the newscasts and everything, people still tell me, man, you got shafted. So I got support, and we decided to go to court. I went out and got a lawyer, and we put a case together. I thought the case could have been stronger, but it was sufficient for me to get before a judge, and I thought the evidence would win the day. After all, we live in America. You know, unfortunately, and I heard the previous call that you had where the gentleman was talking about the problems that we have in our society with, unfortunately, some of these folks that wear the red shirts, they're just blind to partisanship. And the judge, although, you know, we presented, I thought, some very good evidence, he just decided that that wasn't good enough in his court, and I have to wait until 2016.
Mr. Aguilar, wait just one second. I've also got Luis Cuevas with Progressive Push on. Luis,
okay.
Do you have a question for Mr. Aguilar?
I was trying to get back because some of the listeners might not have gotten a couple of things straight that will definitely have envisioned your problem better. The fact is that you had already tried to qualify by signatures for your campaign.
Yeah.
And then because you have a number of given signatures, but you have to go way over them to qualify because, generally speaking, the local elections board will throw away a big number of signatures if they're not at par, and so many other reasons. Then decided to go the next route, which a candidate has that people don't know, and that is that then you have to pay a fee to the
state
of Florida to be able to qualify. And that is when you sent your fee with your paperwork
Correct.
To the state, and you sent it at a time that it got, that it would get to the state on time, delivered, and of course, if anybody looked at the stamp on your envelope from the federal government, it would say that you had already mailed it on such a date. It used to be that at one time that when the federal stamp came down on your envelope saying it was X day of X year, that was automatically, at that point in time, said, that's, on the other side.
Right.
See,
right.
That's done. But these things have been changing. But the fact, the fact that the state comes around and says, no, we will decide when we accept the mail, though it came to us, we did not see it until such and such. Now, whose problem is that?
Mr. Cuevas, if I may, you just brought up a very important point that I illustrated for the judge. you guys are not going to believe this. You're going to think I'm embellishing here, but you know, when my parcel of mail landed in Tallahassee, do you understand that it was less than 800 feet away from the DOE?
Yeah.
It's actually, when you think about the absurdity of what we're talking about, it's actually, you know, Benny Hill could have made a whole comedy routine around this.
Yeah.
It was less than 800 feet. So because the DOE set this policy where they will not receive mail,
mm-hmm.
It goes about a mile and seven tenths away. It's really the trip. I made it. I went within days of getting this nonsense of a story. I went up there to Tallahassee and did my own research. It would have taken 3 minutes to go to the postal office where they set up their depot and
mm-hmm.
pick up the parcel and bring it back.
Right.
But
that was their responsibility. That was their responsibility too.
Absolutely.
On the other hand,
I just wanted to tell you, they would have you believe that a piece of mail that was in Tallahassee for all intents and purposes since the 19th of June, they were not able to retrieve until the 23rd. Until the 23rd. This is the argument that they made in the courtroom and actually got the judge to agree to buy.
and let me ask you, because there's another point that is really interesting, because the Democratic Party headquarters in Tallahassee are not that far away, that somebody from that office could have walked all the way to the State Department offices and check up on that.
Well, you know, and I can see the other side, because there was some discussions after the fact about certain things that they could have done to kind of expedite this situation with the divisions of elections. What I was told at the time was that obviously with so many candidates that they would not be able, you know, and I understood that. You know what?
But that's their job. That's their job. It was like, you know, we all have so much homework that we can get it done on time.
Listen, I agree with you. Listen, here's what I would do. Here's what I would do. I am a process guy. I've worked for the Federal Reserve for almost 10 years, and my career, professional career, was in banking. So you got to have a process around everything. Time stamping, very important in my life. So what I would do is, knowing that these sorts of things happen, this is part of the education for anyone that wants to become a candidate. I mean, I cannot tell you that anyone ever brought that to me as a subject matter, ever. I was left to do what I had to do. I wish someone would have just mentioned to me, hey, you know, when it comes down to qualifying, send it UPS. Go there on your own, like Man Rich told me a week later, on the other coast there. Take it and make it a media event so that you can get additional TV time.
Right.
I wish someone would have told me that, but you know, I was left on my own. And perhaps,
you did not have a campaign manager; you were doing your own campaign.
I did, but no, I did, and believe me, I was very closely tied to the local DEC here. That was the first time I've ever run. So obviously, in order to do things and not let anything get away, you need to let people that have experience help you along the way.
Right.
But I cannot tell you today that there was any moment where anyone ever raised a question to me about issues and problems and concerns related to qualification and the issues with the divisions of elections. But I found out that is not a rare occurrence. That happens quite a lot.
There is, when it comes to that, there is a tremendous amount of problems. And from my own experience helping candidates running campaigns and getting people to qualify, I'll tell you that I once worked with a candidate for Congress who had gotten, at that time he needed, I think it was 4,500 signatures and or pay $10,000. Well, he actually got, we helped him get him over 5,600 signatures. Mm-hmm. And when it came down to the board accepting the signatures, he made it by 13 signatures.
Wow.
You see, so that is something that there's no surprises there. When these things, is you have to, you know, go way over. What they are. Yes, because anything will, you know, just, you know, boot you out. And the same thing that right now we were telling people who were trying to do their vote by mail absentee ballots, there's about 5-6 items that can get your ballot thrown out, and they won't even tell you.
Mm-hmm. Well, gentlemen,
you have to be very careful with that.
This part of the discussion. Thank you so much,
yes,
Mr. Aguilar, for joining us.
Thank you for telling
your story, and hopefully there are candidates out there who will take the wisdom that you've offered and have another tool in their kit to fight the system that's so inclined to stop participation. Thanks so much for sharing your story, sir.
Thank you.
Luis, if you want to stick around, buddy, I'd be glad to have you join me. Our next discussion is going to be, we're going to hear Ms. Susan Smith from the Progressive Caucus give us her perspective on the recent primary. So here we go, Ms. Susan Smith. Hello, Susan.
Hey.
How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Susan, the reason I called you, besides the fact that you're an intelligent, politically astute person, is you are the president of one of the leading progressive organizations in the state. And we just had an election yesterday in Florida, and unfortunately our progressive champion for governor was not elected. I was wondering what your takeaway is from yesterday's election, on that count and on any others you'd care to talk about. So, Susan, what are your thoughts?
Well, I'm very disappointed because I think that the voters are more progressive than yesterday would have shown. I think it was interesting what happened in North Florida, where Nan did much better than she did in South Florida. And I think that's because, you know, the powers that be in the North aren't as influential on their voters, and the voters make up their own minds. And they met Nan, and they liked her. She won in Putnam County. I thought that was interesting. She won the Democratic primary there, and I think Holmes County was the other county she won in. So I think that says a lot about the appeal of the progressive message when people hear it. I think it got drowned out in South Florida because the power brokers down there decided that she wasn't a viable candidate.
Which turns out to be a self-fulfilling prophecy when all those type of individuals define a candidate who they precluded from getting financial support as a person who can't get financial support. Isn't that interesting?
Exactly, yeah. She was definitely cut off at the knees early on, maybe even before she got into the race, and she got into the race a long time ago.
You know, when we took a look at the campaign, there was one candidate who was active out there talking to people, meeting with people, traveling the state. And then there was another candidate who was largely absent from view until the very last stages of the campaign. You know, it seems to me to be an ill-conceived way to reach out to the people if that's their message, if that's their goal. But clearly, that wasn't the goal of the Crist campaign. Do you see any other silver linings in this yesterday's election? I know, of course, the turnout, as usual, was minuscule.
You know, some local races, we had some good results. We had some disappointments. I know I was disappointed that Representative Rangel lost his primary over in on the East Coast. I think he's in Brevard County. But I was really thrilled that Geraldine Thompson won her race against Gary Siplin in the state Senate primary over in the Orange County area. So, you know, there were some bright spots here and there. There were some, you know, really hurtful things that happened. We had a big win in Hillsborough County with one of our caucus members, Pat Kemp, won a Democratic primary for county commission.
That's great.
And not only that, but she got more votes than the Republican incumbent got in his primary. Now, he's running countywide now as opposed to a district level, but still, Pat was able to get more votes out just in her primary than he did. So I think that's a good omen for November with what we can do locally. And we've had such a bad, despite the fact that we outnumber the Republicans in Hillsborough County, we've had, you know, a Republican-dominated county commission for a long time. So it'll be very nice that to have a little more balance on the commission if Pat can pull it off. And we're hopeful that she can, and we want to get as much support as possible for her race.
Let me ask you this. When progressives turn to you and say, Nan, you know, what do you think we should do in this this next election cycle between now and November? Right now, our progressive champion, a woman with great political experience, was not accepted, not elected by the in the Democratic primary. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
and I know many people were very disappointed in the stance the party took. There seemed to be pretty much overt support for one side. Is your counsel to Grin and Bear It, pick up the Crist banner and support it if you can?
Hold on 1 second. Let me turn down the TV. I'm moving to another room, and I don't.
Not a problem. We can edit that out.
You know, I'll tell people to follow their conscience and do what they feel like they have to do. I know defeating Rick Scott is important to a lot of people. Especially the working people of Florida. So I just hope that whoever wins in November, they will pay more attention to the needs of the people than they do the needs of the special interests. I don't think the money that's come in already bodes well for that. But I also think that there are a lot of local races people can turn their attention to if they don't feel comfortable supporting the Chris campaign.
I know, I for one cannot, but that's my opinion. On another front, let me ask you this. I've heard talk in a couple different quarters that Chris is being considered for a second slot in the Hillary run.
I don't know if that was just speculation on television. I heard Chuck Todd say that yesterday morning, and I don't think that was based on any kind of information other than just television speculation, but I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, he's always wanted the bigger prize, you know, that's why he left the governor's race before, so I'm not sure that, we know that Florida's important, but as somebody from Hillsborough County yesterday posted to my Facebook post about that, that he pretty much needs to, or Hillary, if she is the nominee, will need to go to Hispanic or a minority candidate on the ticket with her. So that would eliminate Charlie Crist from consideration.
He is photogenic. Now you can't argue with that. He is a photogenic fellow.
I would argue with that. He's not my type.
I was looking for something positive to say, so you'll forgive me.
Oh, good for you.
I do indulge in heavy lifting from time to time. Well, thank you so much, Susan. Any final word for progressives out there who are looking to put some positive direction in their energy?
Well, I think we can also put a lot of energy into George Sheldon's race. I think we had two good options there with Perry Thurston and George Sheldon, and I think that that's another race that I don't see why it's not winnable if we all don't get out there and really work on it. Pam Bondi's not very popular. I don't even think she's that popular with the Republicans. I think she's embarrassed them a few times over the last 4 years. So I do think that with a little bit of work, we could defeat her. And George Sheldon is a solid progressive, as was Perry Thurston. So I think that that's another place to turn your attention if you want to.
To give Ms. Bondi beyond her due, I mean, she does have a lot of friends in the polluters of Chesapeake Bay.
Yes, she does. Yes, she wrote a Friends of the Court brief or something, didn't she?
Yeah, her? Yeah. So mm-hmm. she does have a friend in dirty places, so best of luck to her and her ilk.
Oh, well, I think she was a surprise to people who knew her locally because she was not seen as a conservative mouthpiece like she is now when she was working in Hillsborough County, and I think she's disappointed a lot of people when they've seen what she's done now that she's up there in Tallahassee.
But, now, again, Susan, she does have that photogenic quality that's so important in elected officials.
She does. That I'll give her that one. That one I'll give to her, not to Chris, but I'll give it to her.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Susan.
You're welcome. Thanks, Rick.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now, that was Susan Smith of the Progressive Caucus. And now I'd like to bring you Ms. Athena Ford with Florida Chain, who's going to talk about the Affordable Care Act and what we have to look forward to in the days ahead.
Hi, this is Athena.
Good morning, Athena. This is Rick Spezak, Progressive News Network. How are you today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I want to first congratulate you on your position with Florida Chain. I'm sure that you've got stories to tell about your work up north in the healthcare outreach arena. But why don't you tell us how things are going with Florida Chain now that the Affordable Care Act has had its first few months in play?
Sure. Well, as you know, Florida Chain is one of the federally funded navigators from the federal government to help people enroll in the marketplace. And what we saw during last open enrollment was a huge success here in Florida compared nationally. There were more people that enrolled in the federal marketplace here in Florida than any other state across the country. Nearly a million Floridians were able to access quality, affordable coverage in the new marketplace. A lot of that credit goes to the hard work of individuals and organizations that really went out into communities to help educate the public about what your options are and then to help people enroll individually.
Well, given all the negative propaganda that was out there, I think that it was really an uphill battle. And clearly, its success speaks to the tremendous need that's out there and still a large part of that need is unfulfilled. But go ahead, tell us more about the good news part of this. Now, is there another open enrollment coming up?
Yes. So right now, it's important for folks to know open enrollment has ended. The healthcare law got rid of discrimination against people because of pre-existing conditions. So from now on, if you are sick or you have a chronic condition like diabetes or heart disease, insurance companies can't deny you coverage based on that. And that's a really big deal. They also can't charge you more for that or say, we're going to cover everything except your bad heart, for example. In order to be able to do that and still make sure that everybody could get coverage that was affordable, the law had to institute open enrollment periods so that folks didn't just enroll when they got sick, but that everybody was able to get access to coverage. And so open enrollment has ended. However, if you get married, if you move, if you lose your coverage, if you get fired from your job, you can still get access to the marketplace right now, even though open enrollment ended. It's what's called a special enrollment period. And so for more information on that, you can go to healthcare.gov or floridachain.org or floridalegalservices.org. There's lots of information out there. and you can still get access to Markley. The new open enrollment period, what folks are calling open enrollment 2.0, that is going to start up on November 15th, and it's going to go through until February 15th.
So
at that point, it doesn't matter what your circumstances are. As long as you don't have health insurance coverage, you can go and check out the marketplace to see what options are available to you.
Oh, that's wonderful. So I imagine there'll be an aggressive outreach campaign starting, what, in September or October?
Well, to be truthful, it's already begun.
Oh, good.
Of course, it's going to get even more aggressive as the months lead up to open enrollment. But as you alluded to before, there's been a lot of misinformation. And let's just be real, this is Florida. So a lot of money is spent here trying to mislead the public about what's actually in health care reform. So there's all of that to try to overcome. And then at the same time, we want to make sure that folks understand what their options are. And so there have been, we've been out doing a lot of community presentations. We've been out trying to get deep into communities. A lot of other organizations, huge effort across the state of organizations and individuals taking on this responsibility as well. But of course, we need everybody's help. So for your listeners right now who want to know what they can do, if they know about the health insurance marketplace, even though we had this great success last year, it's really important that you tell your friends and family that you know don't have coverage that there's this opportunity for them to get insured.
You know, those of us who pay attention to these matters know that the state of Florida, to put it kindly, left money on the table when it comes to help that could have come from the federal government. Do you sense, those of you who are in the trenches fighting for better health care for everyone, do you sense that there's any change of heart? Granted, it's an election year and positions tend to ossify, but do you think there's any change in the offing for Florida government and as far as getting some of that federal money that's been just turned away?
You know, Rick, we actually see this as a really exciting window coming up here in 2015 to make sure that we close the coverage gap. And so we are launching a full-on campaign to make sure that happens this year. As you mentioned, this is not an election year now in 2015, and so it's always easier to get things done on these off years. But more importantly, there has been such an outcry in this community across the state, Republicans and Democrats, people who are insured, people who are uninsured, people who want to see Obamacare repealed, still want us to close this disgraceful gap and take the money from the federal government to do that. There is just so much tremendous support and real pressure on our lawmakers right now to get this done that we're confident, well, we're hopeful, I should say, that this will be the year. But of course, in order for that to happen, we need to keep this pressure going. And so, again, I'm going to encourage folks to check out floridachain.org. There's a lot of different ways to get involved in this campaign. It's exciting, it's inspiring, and it's the reason these people who have been left out are the reason so many of us fought to pass health care reform in the first place. We have to get this piece done.
You know, Athena, I was in Denver. I attended the convention as an official journalist, and I heard Democrat after Democrat after Democrat on the podium guarantee universal health care. And boy, we fell away from that. The Affordable Care Act is a huge, tremendous step in the right direction, but the battle has to continue. I can tell you from my personal experience, I probably know personally 30 people who now have access to health care who didn't before, and I'm sure that, you know, a close study would find. Is there any sense of what that gap is? I mean, how many Floridians are we talking about who just are
yeah.
still out of reach of medical care?
There's 1.2 million Floridians that would qualify for coverage. And then to get a little too number picky, I don't usually do this here, but there are 800,000 Floridians right now that are stuck in the gap, which means that they make less than the federal poverty line, which is like, I'm forgetting the numbers off the top of my head, but around $12,000 or $13,000 a year for an individual. So because they make less than that, they can't get those subsidies in order to buy coverage in the new health insurance marketplace. And since we didn't take the money that's offered to us by the new healthcare law to give these folks coverage, they're left uninsured. And so what this means is that, you know, there's financial help for a family of four making up to $90,000 a year to buy private health insurance. And that's good. There should be. But there's no help for a home health aide making $12,000 a year with one kid, for example, or a hairdresser with two kids. These are the types of people that are left out in the cold and unable to access the care that they need.
You know, just to think for a second, what kind of genius would imagine that you could be too poor to get health care support? It just... it is mind-blowing. It's such a conceptual minefield. Let's talk again a little bit more about the kind of care that's available. Now, of course, though, again, those of us who pay attention know that the insurance companies can't lock us out because of pre-existing conditions, which, again, is a kind of interesting reasoning all by itself. You can't get care because you need it. I don't know what person in the insurance industry thought of that concept, but it's worked for them. Can you talk about the kind of care that people can access if they're able to be engaged in the Affordable Care Act?
Absolutely. And I do want to just quickly clarify, too, that the healthcare law wasn't written with this intention or with this gap. What happened, and I'm sure most of your listeners are probably aware, the Supreme Court ruled that this piece now is optional for folks who make less than the federal poverty. And so about 27 states have already taken the option. They're seeing not only are they able to then take tens of billions of dollars from the federal government to cover folks below the poverty line, but bringing all that money into their economy, they're creating tens of thousands of new jobs, they're seeing a big economic boost. It's really a no-brainer. and for those people who make more than 100% of federal poverty, and so now are able to get the help, the financial help to buy private health care coverage, or who have it through their job already, you're right, they do have a whole new host of protections, and it's really exciting. The kind of care that they can get, every plan has to meet what's called an essential health benefits package. Every plan is sold in a small group and individual group marketplace. And this is a really big deal. Florida was one of those states where, for example, insurance companies didn't have to cover pregnant women. And believe it or not, some insurance policies didn't cover maternity care. And so what was happening was that a woman had coverage through her husband's small business job or because she purchased it on her own or through her job. And then she would realize that, oh my goodness, this doesn't cover maternity coverage and I'm pregnant. And then she would try to buy healthcare coverage in the private marketplace and find that she has a pre-existing condition, pregnancy, so she can't buy coverage. These kinds of things were happening in this state, and the problems that we were experiencing here were not just that people didn't have health insurance, but for people who had it, they didn't have quality coverage. It didn't actually cover some of the things that they needed that to cover. And so now, thanks to the Essential Health Benefits Package, we know that all of these different benefits have to be covered. Anybody can go online and see the list of them. But one thing to know, that members of Congress, when they wrote this law, they wrote it so that in 2014, they lost their health insurance and they went into the marketplace. So when they wrote that essential health benefits package, you better believe they put in it everything that they would want to see covered in their own health insurance plan.
An important point. Oh, if the minimum wage only went up as often as their salaries do, huh?
Sure is.
So let's take a typical situation. A person X suddenly finds themselves, their company had offered some minimum care. Now their company's closed. They're on their own. What first step should they take?
The first thing I would do is I personally recommend speaking with a navigator or what's called a certified application counselor. For the purposes of the individual consumer, the differences between the two don't really matter. It basically, navigators got federal funding and they also have to go out and do some education. Community certified application counselors, they also had to go through some serious training to make sure that they knew that they were best equipped to handle and to work with personal consumers. So I would recommend going and seeing one of those folks. You could go to localhealth.healthcare.gov to search for one near you. But if you don't want to go that route, you can also just go to healthcare.gov and explore it for yourself, see what the options are. When walking through the marketplace, there are a couple things you want to be mindful of. If you make less money, if you just got laid off, for example, so unemployment is your salary, a silver level plan is probably what's the best plan option for you because it may cover more costs. So you have to pay less out-of-pocket expenses. This means that you won't only get financial help to pay for the premiums, but you'll also get financial help to pay for your copays and stuff like that. Again, sitting down and talking with a certified application counselor or a navigator means that you can sit one-on-one with somebody and talk through all of these options. So realistically, if you're a busy person, you just lost your job, you're out hunting for jobs, you don't have time for something like that, you can always call the 1-800 number that's on healthcare.gov too and call the call center to talk it through with somebody.
Well, that's great. It's so great that that's a good option because there are so many people. I mean, we tend to think of our society as very savvy in technology and very computer literate, but I work in the field and I know there's an awful lot of people that are, you know, by and large untouched by the technology revolution. And any computer site, any computer issue can be quite daunting to them. So I'm so glad that they have that 800 number as well. Let me ask you this. The act, as I understand it, is going to take, is evolving in itself. They're talking about having, you know, the small businesses are going to be engaged by it. Are there any other consumer side evolutions that are taking place? In other words, it's going to cover more things, or it's going to take, you know, the costs are going to be reduced. Or can you talk about any changes that the consumers can expect, say, in the next year?
Oh, so many, and it's so exciting. So for example, there's something called a cap on out-of-pocket expenses now. If you're buying, you're one of these nearly 1 million Floridians who've got your coverage through the marketplace, or one of the nearly 1 million more, maybe that's an overreach, of the folks who are going to get it during the next open enrollment. You know, if you're one of these people, there's now what's called a cap on out-of-pocket expenses, which means that once you hit that, for the rest of the year, you're not going to pay any more costs out-of-pocket. And those caps are actually set rather high, and most of us are never going to hit them. But they're designed for people who have very expensive chronic conditions. So if I have cancer, I have to go for chemo treatments regularly. That has a high copay, and it's expensive. Once I pay so much money of that for the rest of the year, I'm not going to have to pay that out of pocket. That means that I'm not, even though I have health insurance, I'm not going to go broke. There are no more limits on lifetime and annual limits of coverage, which means that if I have a $3 million health insurance policy, but I develop MS, or I get MS, that can be a very expensive condition to treat. And over a few years, I could blow through $3 million worth of care and be left uninsured. That would be the situation prior to 2014. Thanks to the healthcare law, there's no such thing as there's lifetime limits, and I can have the security of knowing that my coverage is going to be there for the long haul. So there's a lot of really exciting new consumer protections and developments, and I'll tell folks, too, if you're interested in really learning about all of your new rights and protections, healthcare.gov, that good information. But Florida Chain, we're hosting a webinar on Thursday at 1 o'clock in the afternoon that goes through all of these, really in depth and really going to spell out your rights and what the healthcare law means for you.
So that would be this coming Thursday, the first week of September?
Yes.
And you say 1 o'clock?
Mm-hmm, correct.
Now, how does one register for that webinar?
It's online, and I can send you the link. But then, you know, for folks that don't do the online thing as much, they should still feel free to contact us at Florida Chain, and we'll see maybe about setting up a call or something like that in the future.
Okay, that sounds good. Yeah, please send me the link. Do you have my email address?
I'm not sure. I
can give
no,
it to you real quick.
So.
It's J is in John, A is in Apple, N is in Nancy, H is in Harry, U is in Umbrella, S is in Sam, S is in Sam, so it's Jan Huss at bellsouth.net.
Thank you.
Sure, thank you. Let me ask you this. You worked in Pennsylvania, now you're down here. What differences do you see in how Pennsylvania implemented the healthcare law versus Florida?
Well, Pennsylvania has moved forward with what's called a waiver proposal. Basically, that just means there's a lot of flexibility from the federal government. States have the opportunity to implement and close this coverage gap in a way that really makes sense for that state, and that's going to fix the state health care program. And so, Pennsylvania took advantage of that and designed its own program. It just came out yesterday that CMS approved this, and so I'm really not able to speak on it with much authority because I certainly haven't reviewed it, and I know that the advocates on the ground in that state are still in the process of reviewing it and have some concerns about the proposal that Pennsylvania moved forward with and whether or not it'll meet all the needs of the recipients. But what's important to know is that Florida has those same kinds of opportunities. There is a lot of flexibility from the government, from the federal government. There is the opportunity to design a program here that would best fit the needs of Floridians.
Well, that's interesting. I'm sure that given the, let's say, political background of Florida, you'll find this a very challenging state to work in. But you sound very much up to the challenge. May I ask you a couple of personal questions? When did you decide that you wanted to work in, should we say, community healthcare?
It was I was probably about 12 or 13 years old when I knew that I wanted to work in social justice.
Oh, how nice.
And I dreamed of doing the job that I have right now, working with fun, creative, dedicated people and working on issue-based campaigns that I believed in. So I feel very grateful to be working on this. The opportunity to work on healthcare came up for me about 5 years ago. I worked with a tremendous advocate in Pennsylvania, Antoinette Krause, and I was able to learn from her and from all of our coalition partners some ways to do this work really effectively. And that was very meaningful to me because everybody in my family in one way or another had been affected by a broken healthcare system. So my father is a very small business owner. We had sometimes one employee when I was growing up, but wasn't able to give healthcare coverage to that employee because of how expensive it was. My brother was born with what's called cleft lip and palate, where his face was split open. And insurance companies didn't want to cover that because they said it was a cosmetic procedure.
Oh, my
God. And then when we moved, then it was a big fight to find an insurance company that would still cover his medical needs when it came to that.
Because that was a pre-existing condition.
Right. So I have been through this. I watched my parents. I remember the kitchen table just covered with health insurance policies, reading through the fine print, the hours where my mom should have spent just helping her baby boy get through his first couple years of life. So many of them were spent arguing with health insurance companies. So being able to be part of a movement that put some of those really abusive practices to end is something that I take a lot of pride in.
My goodness, you were really raised to this job, huh?
Here, here.
Well, that's fantastic. If there was one thing that you think people should know about Florida Chain, what would that be?
I would want people to know that we are here as a resource for you when it comes to information that you need to access your benefits, and when it comes to when you want to plug into this movement, we're here for that too. So we just launched a brand new group called Chain Reactors, And there's a sign-up form for that on our website, too. We're going to have our first call, kickoff call, on September 10th. But if you can't make it to that, you should still join the group. It's a really exciting group of grassroots activists who want to be part of this campaign to close the gap. But, you know, and maybe you've written a letter or you've made that call to your lawmaker, you want to do more, but we all have really busy lives and don't really have the time for that. So these folks will be on the front lines when a rapid response action needs to occur. But then also you have the opportunity, if you want, to call in once a month. I'm the advocacy director. I'm going to get on the calls personally. Our CEO will be on there sometimes. We really want to be hearing from the folks from the grassroots base that helped us win healthcare reform on what are your ideas to help us win closing this coverage gap. So you'll have the opportunity to weigh in on grassroots strategy. There'll be exciting speakers. We'll be doing lots of training. And, yeah, anything that we can do, whatever we have to do to make sure that we win this year.
Well, I can speak from personal experience. I've been in technology and multimedia for most of my adult life. And my family's been without health care since the late 90s. And it was only when we got the Affordable Care Act, because there were pre-existing conditions in play, and through the Affordable Care Act, my family is now covered again. And that's, I can only say thanks to all those activists who tried to put universal health care in play. And I thank you for the work that you're doing to try to make sure that what coverage we have really does cover the people in need. And I think that's fantastic. Thank you so much for your work.
Thank you very much for giving us this time and for covering this.
Well, anytime you have an announcement you'd like to make, please let us be one of your media resources, okay?
Oh, certainly will. It's good to meet you via the phone. And I look forward to speaking with you again.
I'm sure we'll see each other on some barricade or other.
here.
Okay, you
Thank
take
you
care.
Thank you very much.
And have a good day.
See
and
you.
Best of luck to all the good people at Florida Chain.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Not to waste any further time, I want to go right into the interview with Mr. Will Rankin, candidate for CFO.
Hello, it's Will.
Hello, Will. This is Rick Spezak, Progressive News Network. How are you doing today?
Good. Hey, Rick. It's good to hear from you.
Will, you've got an interesting candidacy. But before we start talking about your agenda, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about yourself. What motivated you as a young man to get involved in civic activities? You know, for many people, just making a living, just having a few friends, having a family is more than they can almost cope with. But there's a special kind of person that says, yes, all of that, but I want to help. I want to make this a better place. What was it in your life, sir?
Well, you know, thank you for the question. It's you know, people don't ask that so much. But, you know, for me, my background, I grew up very humble, meager, you know, economic background with my family. My father was a blue-collar laborer, was a union worker, a union steel worker, and a union auto worker at different points in time. And my grandparents, you know, my grandfather on my mother's side was a union coal worker. My grandfather on my father's side was a union bricklayer. Even my grandmother was a AFL-CIO union textile, amalgamated textile clothing worker.
Excellent.
So that is the environment that I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, in an area called Athens State, which is, you know, a very low-income area at the bottom of Price Hill in Cincinnati, Ohio. And we grew up that way. And so, you know, we didn't always have a lot, but we, you know, we always made ends meet. And then my father had a series of different jobs, and we moved around a lot, you know, and it just got at different points in times where you know, we had to live in subsidized housing, in government housing. And as a young kid living in government housing, I was in a neighborhood where I was the only white kid in my elementary class, and we were the only white family for like 10 square blocks, Rick. And, you know, and you know, at that point in time, it's not about race. It's about economic equality. You know, you're all the same at that point in time.
Absolutely.
And so I grew up in that environment, and I was just the type of person and kid that always felt like, you know, like this should be better. Things can be better. And I just always had a personal drive that I could do better. So growing up, I always excelled in school, and I excelled in sports. So I was in, you know, we lived in government housing all the way up until I graduated from high school, and then I went straight from high school into the military and was in the military for 11 years. And more so, I was in law enforcement, and I specifically recall making the decision that I wanted to not only serve my country, but I wanted to serve people, and by doing that in law enforcement. And so, you know, so the entire 11 years that I was in the Army, I was in law enforcement, serving not only my country, but serving my local community as well.
That's so inspiring. I grew up in the Pittsburgh area of Union Stock, the son and grandson of mill workers, the son and grandson of railroad workers, and the welders. And we had that same feeling. When you grow up in a union household, you have a real sense that we're in this together, that we have to pull together. And
absolutely.
So many people that I know that are committed to a work of doing work to help the community, they've had that experience. They've been in a household. They grew up in a house where people valued helping each other.
Right, and you do. You're absolutely right. You know, and you being from Pittsburgh, me from Cincinnati, we're like sister cities. You know,
absolutely.
We're like cousins, you and I.
Absolutely.
And when you tell somebody, and you know this, you know, when me saying I'm from Cincinnati and giving you my background and you the same, you and I have a kindred spirit already. So we know each other and we know where that comes from. You know, trying to communicate that to an entire state of folks to let them know who you are when often all you have is 2 minutes, you know, to speak is really difficult. But, you know, the more that we get around the state, the more that we talk about it, the more that people learn who we are. And so, you know, just beyond that, you know, I got out of the service because I had service-connected disabilities. I'm a 40% permanent disabled veteran and, you know, used the VA benefits to finish my school and finish my degree. I've got a Bachelor's of Science in Business Administration and a major in Economics from Xavier University in Cincinnati, and went on to parlay that and my experience in law enforcement. When I retired from the Army, I was a special agent for the Army Criminal Investigations, where I specialized in investigating economic crimes and fraud against the government.
Wow.
And then I parlayed that. Yeah. Well, and I appreciate that, and I appreciate that I have a very unconventional background, as you sort of alluded to in the beginning. But it's these diversities that I bring to this race and to the Office of Chief Financial Officer for Florida, and it goes just beyond that. I mean, I parlayed that into business consulting, which I've done for years and years, helping companies expand and grow, starting my own businesses, doing international business as well. For like the last 12 years, I've been going back and forth overseas in South Africa and the Middle East and Europe. I started a publishing company in South Africa, and then after a couple of years moved it to London. And between that, I was involved in politics and had several appointments, and was appointed as the director of asset management for the State Treasury of Ohio, where I ran the state's $120 billion public trust custodial operation, which in large part is the same thing that the CFO does here in Florida. So my experiences are vast. They're public service, they're military, it's law enforcement at a very high level. It's being a state fiduciary for over $100 billion, private business sector, international business, and these are all of the diversities that I'm bringing to Florida. And so as being a Floridian for the last 15 years and seeing what's been going on in the last 16 years of Republican leadership here and the pure stagnation of any innovation or any movement forward. And the Republicans tout numbers, but you know they're just using the numbers to back into whatever position that they want to have. Because the truth is, as you go around the state, as I go around the state, and I talk to Floridians, they feel as I do, as I feel that they do, the stagnation and the hopelessness that anything is actually getting done. And you know, Rick, I knew that I could do something about it. I knew that I had the background, the education, and the global experience to bring best practices to the state of Florida and implement those. because I'm not a career politician, and I have no political agenda except to do the very best I can for all the people of Florida.
Well, I couldn't imagine a more qualified person to take on the CFO responsibilities for this state. When you look at the kind of banditry that's been represented from the governor straight on down the line, when mm-hmm. you look at the malfeasance, it really calls out for someone who can really take a clean slate, look at this stuff with a serious business eye, and I think your background as an investigator of fraud, as a journalist, I think that's very exciting.
Well, you know, and I appreciate it, and there's direct applications, because the chief financial officer for the state of Florida, who administers the Department of Financial Services, is in charge of the state's insurance fraud investigation division.
It would be nice if that department was actually activated, huh?
Yeah. And so my opponent, one of the things that's different between him and I is that he, as basically the head of that organization, he goes after the low-hanging fruit. He goes after fraudsters who are, you know, have frauded the state out of $100,000 or $300,000, and I don't want to make it sound like that's petty, because it's not. But we've got major corporations out there who are frauding the state of Florida out of tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions. And certainly, we have a governor who was the head of a major insurance company that frauded the entire United States out of billions of dollars. And so, and this is what I tell people, you know, especially like as I go around and I talk to unions and teachers and public employees who we're responsible to not only watch over their pension funds and their livelihoods for their futures and their families, but to also ensure that that money is being invested for all of their purposes, for no other nefarious purposes, but only for theirs. And so a lot of people don't understand the mechanism of how it's set up. But the Florida's retirement system, retirement fund, is overseen by what's known as the State Board of Administration, the SBA. The SBA trustees are the governor, the CFO, and the attorney general. So right now what we have is we have a governor, one of the trustees, who was the head of one of the biggest frauding companies in the history of the United States. We have another trustee, the CFO, who was a part of a bank in Palm Beach that had to be taken over by the FDIC for $500 million because it was ran into the ground. It was mismanaged. Now, he touts himself as being a banking executive, but when he was questioned on it, he goes, oh, no, I wasn't a part of the management of it. I was just, you know, in sales. And then the other third person on the SBA right now, that Pam Bondi, the Attorney General, has absolutely no business or financial experience whatsoever. Not any education, not a degree in business, not any experience, nothing. And so these are the three people that are responsible for the direction of protecting and investing the people's money. And I believe that the people of Florida deserve more. They deserve better than that. And with Will Rankin as CFO, they have that. They have somebody who has been a state fiduciary. They have somebody who was a criminal investigator with the highest level of ethics. They have somebody who's been in business, who has their own business. Okay, so we have an entire initiative, an economic development plan for the state of Florida that moves the state forward. And at the very least, these are financial and economic initiatives and programs that can be discussed in terms of finding what is the most applicable. And a lot of these are things that need to be discussed and worked out with the state legislature as well. So we need a governor and we need a CFO who has the will and the ability and the desire to work across the aisles and work with the legislatures. Now, not being a political career politician, not coming from the state legislature, I'm perfectly accessible and open to talking to any and all legislators about what it is that we can do together to move this state forward. And I would say that this is the biggest difference between me and my opponent, because if they did have that mind, if they were of that mind and had that notion, they'd already be doing it. But they're
not. Absolutely right. And what we continue to hear when the subject of the state's
responsibilities, its investments, and of course, especially its requirements to look over the retirement plans of the state employees. What we constantly are hearing is schemes to take these funds and take them in another direction to remove
absolutely
those.
And I have a lot of experience in this, you know, and honestly, you know, I don't want to sound curt about this, but this isn't rocket science. You know, financial schemes and financial investments are a finite field, especially when you're talking about state assets and people's money. You know, there are certain limitations that we have to work with them. But the point is that, you know, as I go around and I talk to public employees around the state, and my position is that if we're going to be talking about changing your contribution plans and the structures of your pension moving forward, you should have the right to be at the table for those conversations. As such, every year the Republican leadership talks about how they want to change the contribution plan, change the structure, and then the unions have to lobby them in order not to do them. Instead of having a constructive, overt type of discussion with them about what is in the best interest of them and their memberships. And so, you know, unions should be afforded every right to be able to agree upon their salaries, their work conditions, you know, the type of contracts that they have, and that those should be secured, and that their assets, their money that are going into their retirement funds, while they are state monies per se, they actually belong to the people because of the service that they provide to all of us and their community. So in particular, the one thing that I'm most aggrieved about for them is the 3% contribution participation that was levied against them by Governor Rick Scott and the Republican legislatures. It was a boondoggle. They went around the state promoting this as, you know, the public employees must help to, you know, the state and help the recovery because there was a $500 million shortfall in the retirement fund. And the fact of the matter is that there was not. The fact of the matter is that the state of Florida has one of the soundest retirement funds in the entire country. It's funded over 80% of its obligations, which in industry standards is superb. There's no shortcoming. So basically what Rick Scott and the Republicans did was penalize the public employees and gave them a 3% pay cut. Well, as CFO, when I become CFO, I will publicize the real numbers. I will talk about how it's not necessary, and I will do everything that I can in my power to work with the governor to lobby the legislatures to repeal that law, because it is absolutely not necessary and is penalizing our hardworking public employees and their families.
Well, I hope that we can help you get your message out, because it sounds like you're offering a message of fiscal responsibility, of clear-eyed transparency, and an end to these, let's just say the standard snake oil that's been peddled to Floridians for too damn long.
Absolutely, Rick. And, you know, and I say this as I go around the state and introducing myself and talking about the issues and listening to what people have to say, I always say this to everybody. In the end, I say, you know what, all of this boils down to really one thing and one thing only. Do you ask yourself, within yourself, do you feel better off today than you did 4 years ago? And if the answer is no, then what I'm asking is give me an opportunity to be a voice for all of us, and with my background and my tenacity, to make a change that's positive for us, a change that allows access to the opportunities that are out there. Because that's one of the biggest roadblocks right now that the Republican Party does. They may create programs and say, okay, well, we've got this program for whatever, and we've funded it, and it has, you know, $20 million in it, but they don't create a structure where there's access to it. So then they claim, well, we have a program, but no one's using it, but there's not access. And so this is ridiculous. You know, we need to be able to reach out to the community and make sure that the community understands that there are programs out there for them, and make sure that we put the resources behind it so that people can access those without the bureaucracy of people just throwing up their hands and saying, you know what, this isn't worth it. I've got to go get a job, or I've got a job to get to. I've got kids I got to pick up from school. And we're all, and I know that we all have felt that before.
Well, you know, there's a reason why there's such cynicism about government. There's a reason why people view all too often voting as a pointless exercise, because they've been misled so consistently and for so long and so often. And, you know, I think it's a real breath of fresh air to hear someone like you who's got the experience to do the, if you will, the forensic back digging to find out what's really going on, and then to give them a commitment, to give them a real clear picture of what can be done so that they're not just being plucked, to put it ungently.
Well, you know, and I appreciate that, Rick. And certainly, you know, from my personal perspective, I know that that's where I'm coming from. But there are, you know, there are powers out there who do not want that to happen. and the people need to know that if we stand together, all of us, and I'm not just talking about my own Democratic Party, all of us, Republicans who feel disenfranchised, and certainly the 2.5 million or more registered, independent, non-party affiliated people, I say to all of them, come with me, join me, and joining all of us and having a unified voice that says, you know what, this isn't about party. This is about who is the right person for this job right now. And, you know, my opponent, he may be a good guy, and he's been involved in politics for now 15 years, but I keep looking and I keep asking, what is it that he has done for the people? Now, I can point out where he has done for the power companies like Duke and Florida Power and Light. He's done for them when he was in the Senate. He passed legislation that benefited them. He's done for the insurance companies because they contributed hundreds of thousands of dollars to his campaign supporting him, because he has supported them in keeping rates high so that they can bilk the public. So basically, it's the public paying inflated insurance rates who are supporting his campaign through the insurance company's contributions. Now, you know, how fair is that?
None at all. And you know, this is a state that has conscienced the billing of electric company customers in advance for plants that they weren't even responsible to actually build.
Exactly.
You know, it's almost a fraudster's dream state where anything goes.
well, when you have a governor who is probably the most notorious fraudster in the whole history of the United States, then it makes sense. And so, you know, there's no doubt in my mind what's going on in Tallahassee. But the truth of the matter is that leadership in Tallahassee, that governor, that CFO, that attorney general, and that agriculture commissioner who makes up the cabinet and sets on all the boards and sets on the Power and Transmission Commission that promotes the policies for energy companies, you know, they just passed an initiative allowing Florida Power and Light to build more power plants down in South Florida and run those cables right through Coral Gables against the opposition of the community, and to build them in advance for it. I mean, and this is absurd. These are energy companies that are making billions in profits. And you know, and coming from the same Republicans who tout free market society, then let them go out and raise their own capital to build their own facilities and then bill us after the fact. But why should we as Floridians be on the hook to make them billions of dollars and the contracts that they're going to lend out to construct these things and the windfalls that they're going to take in those contracts? This is absurd. This is obscene. And this is the kind of things that, as chief financial officer for Florida and as a cabinet member for Florida, is unacceptable to me personally and will not stand for the people. I will call this out each and every time that I find it.
Well, let me ask you this. Obviously, you've got a nest of vipers to clean out. You've got vested interests so tightly woven into the structure of this government that it really, the imagination pales. But let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. If you were to try to describe the agenda that you're going to take, what would you put at the top five places in your agenda?
Certainly
when
the
you
number
get
one,
elected.
Yeah, when I'm elected as chief financial officer for Florida, and you're right, there are so many things to clean up, so much. It will take 4 years. But there are certain things to clean up, and there are certain initiatives that need to get done. Now, fortunately, it's a huge office. The Florida Department of Financial Services is I believe, the third largest state agency with, you know, tens of thousands of employees and offices in every major metropolitan area. So there are several things simultaneously that I can do because we'll have the staff to implement to do it. First and foremost is we have got to get the insurance industry in check. This is absurd that they run amok and that the Republicans allow it because the insurance companies support them and their political agendas. So one of the very first things that I want to do is working with the fellow cabinet members to form an insurance reform commission that actually incorporates insurance trial lawyers, insurance people from the insurance company, and business leaders, not from just Florida, but from all around the country, who can bring best practices to the table. And that in a short period of time, we can talk about what's being done best in other states and how we can bring all that together under one constructive reform program for the state of Florida that is second to none in anywhere in the country, where we've got an insurance industry that provides broad-based services and products to the people of Florida, where they don't just come in and cherry-pick because it's just more advantageous for them to have one thing and not another, and where our insurance rates premiums fall in line with the average, the national average. Because here's the truth of the matter. Insurance companies say, well, you know what, if a catastrophe happens in Florida, we can't afford it. We can't absorb a major hurricane loss. Well, that's not true. If they were just a Floridian company, then perhaps. But when you've got major national insurance companies where they have 50 basically different divisions or state operations, but they fall under one umbrella, they have a massive amount of profits that they can call upon to cover those inevitabilities. My argument is this. They're an insurance company. That's their job. That's their business. And so, but the people of Florida should not be built in the process. And so that's where someone like me, with my ethical background, my law enforcement and business background, I'm going to step up to the plate and I'm going to say, you know what, the people of Florida have had enough. That's certainly why I would be elected, because the people know, like them, I've had enough. And so I'm going to stand there right in front of them and the leaders of this industry and the leadership in politics in Tallahassee and say, we can do better. We can do better. The Republicans, what you get out of them when you ask them why insurance rates are so high, all you get is the sound of crickets in the background. Because they don't have an answer, because there is no answer. Because the honest answer is, you know what? They're making profit. Their profit is supporting my political agenda. And so, you know, we're happy with that. And, you know, and I keep hearing all these stories all the time, and I even have my own personal insurance story that I'd be happy to share, but I keep hearing stories all the time about people who put in claims, they're automatically denied the first time, then they got to put them in again. The insurance companies have a systematic process where they deny first claims, and then, you know, they stretch it out for 60, 90 days, so half of the people give up making the claims, the other people persevere, and then when they're forced to actually pay a claim, then after they pay the claim, they terminate the policy. Well, that will never stand with Will Rankin as CFO.
Well, that's good to hear. I once attended, I do internet marketing and web design and web media, and I was attending a meeting where my job was to come up with a marketing plan for this product, and we're at this meeting, and the meeting was to meet with this insurance gentleman who was described to me as the richest man in Boca Raton. And he was going to provide insurance for us to sell on this website. And the way he described this was he wanted to provide insurance for a very, very broad range of services, from an auto breakdown to medical care to health care for the elderly. I mean, it was really amazingly comprehensive. And I'm sitting here thinking, you know, okay, where's the catch? Where's the hook? Because this is all sounding way too good to be true.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to mention the show will continue. If you're listening on broadcast, tune back in to get the final piece. I also want to thank our fellow progressive broadcasters, Gwen Oldenberry, her show Here Be Monsters, Sita Baguil, Sita Media, Sue Nylon, The Nylon Report, Anita Stewart with Wise Women Media, Harriet Lerman, The Voice of the People, and Brian Stetton and his show Progress Toward Democracy. Tune into them as well. Rick Spezak, Progressive News Network.
I understood everything he was talking about until that one comment he made that, well, there will be some breakage. I said, what the heck did he mean by that? I mean, if it's a vase, it can break. If it's a bottle, it can break. If it's a T-shirt, maybe it could be torn. But what do you mean there'll be mm-hmm. breakage when it comes to insurance? And you know what it was explained to me? Mm. Breakage meant that accidentally, sometimes, once in a while, they might have to actually pay somebody. That's what they regarded as breakage. And I said, that is so unconscionable. How can your business be model, how can your business model be, we're in gravy until somebody actually wants us to do what we're supposed to be doing? That's unbelievable.
Well, you know, look, when I was doing criminal investigations, I had one rule of thumb always in every investigation that I participated in, which is where there's smoke, there's fire. And so, you know, when you just look around what's going around the state, and again, this is one of the main reasons why I got involved in politics and why I came in at a higher level than starting off at a more local level, because the problems are of such magnitude that my background lends to this problem-solving environment. So that, you know, we've got large aggregate problems where what the people deserve is someone who has the experience and the wherewithal to be able to present to them the truth and the facts, the absolute facts of what are going on and the transparency of it all. Now, I know that my opponent, one of the things that he touts is this transparency that he's promoted, this program, whatever. But when you go online to look at the transparency, all you get is line item budgetary information, and you get no background whatsoever. That's not transparency. So it just says the X amount was spent for this. But it gives you no background of what it was spent for. And even if it did, it is so complex, so comprehensive. The average person would have no idea what it means. You would have to be a forensic auditor to be able to go back and really go back through the layers of things to determine what it is. But that's just the nature of politics. The truth of the matter is that my opponent, in the office that he is in right now, from the very beginning, he was ill-equipped to do it, and I say that he's still ill-equipped to do it. He just gets by to get along. He has done nothing measurable for the people. He's got one program that he talks about, the money that's given back, unclaimed property that's been given back to the people. But at a minimum, that's his job anyway. But where is the added value? The people of Florida deserve more. And so this is my argument, is that when Rick Scott and the Republican leadership and the legislature was imposing this 3%, what I call tax, on the people, on the public employees, where was his voice? Where was his voice for the people, for the public employees and their families? And when that same leadership was wanting to change the contribution structure in opposition to the public employees, again, where was his voice? And as soon as Rick Scott, my opponent Jeff Atwater, Pam Bondi, and Adam Putnam were elected in January, in March of that same first year, 2011, they, who make up the clemency board, they changed the automatic rights restoration application process that was previously established by then-Republican Governor
Rick Scott, and Alex Sink, Democrat, and Bronson, who joined together in a bipartisan way to do the right thing. But as soon as they had an opportunity, and I mean the first board meeting that they had on the clemency board, they revoked that executive rule. And as a result, we've got 1.5 million non-violent ex-felons who don't have their rights restored. And how is that fair? And from an economic perspective, how is that beneficial to the state? I mean,
we could
go on and on and on and on. I mean, you know, the cabinet sits on the Department of Veteran Affairs Board. When I get elected as CFO, I will be the first ever disabled veteran cabinet officer sitting on the Board of Veteran Affairs. And so as a former law enforcement officer, we also sit on the board of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. I'll be the first former law enforcement officer sitting on the board of Florida Department of Law Enforcement. So I bring a vast amount of experience, actual first-hand experience, to state government, to Tallahassee, for the benefit of the people.
Well, sir, I certainly hope that you get a chance to serve the state of Florida. Clearly, Florida needs you desperately, and if there's anything this show can do to help you, you please count on us, sir. We are in.
Well, we've got 2 months. We've got some 68 days or something like that left. I'm always happy to come back on, talk about any particular issues,
sure.
or just reiterate. You know, what is at stake here for Floridians? I mean, you know, we have got to have a new governor. This governor that we have now is absurd. It is an embarrassment. You know what? I just recently, I'm not going to say names, but I just recently spoke to a leading Democratic elected official in the state of Kentucky who was telling me about when Rick Scott was heading up Columbia when they were headquartered out of Kentucky,
right.
And he said that they tried to do everything they could to run him out of that state because he was single-handedly destroying that state. He is single-handedly destroying this state as well. I mean, just the absolute absurd disingenuousness that comes from him and that administration and that office around this state, and how he does one thing and says another. And then when it comes election time, now he has a whole change of heart, and somehow he's going to change who he is. I mean, I'm telling you, from someone who spent 11 years in law enforcement, when someone can be a part of a company that systematically, knowingly, with a program, frauds the government and the people out of billions of dollars, he's going to change. They don't change. They just get caught. That is my experience from law enforcement. That level of narcissism doesn't change. It only gets stopped when they get caught and they're in jail.
Well, sir, thank you again for joining us. And we'll be inviting you back on a regular basis until you're elected. And then after you're elected, we'll invite you back then, too. How's that?
Absolutely. That would be a pleasure and an honor.
Well, sir, thank you again, and I hope everybody's been paying attention. This is a gentleman we need to vote for. Thank you again,
well,
sir.
You know, everyone can, you know, they can learn more about me and my platform by going forward.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah. In school today, dear.
We'll leave on a little bit of Pete Speaker.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody's free. That's what the teacher said to me. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that policemen are my friends. I learned that justice never ends. I learned that murderers die for the crimes, even if we make a mistake sometime. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
Good night, everyone. See you next week.